Hi, everyone. This is Marion from the Talking Information Center, and this is the Patriot Ledger for Tuesday, August 18th. The first story is entitled, My Music Gotten Me There. This is a story about a Scituate woman who was a contender. Scituate native Kate Lorraine visited Los Angeles in late July, but not as a tourist. It was very much a business trip, as she was a nominee for Singer-Songwriter of the Year for the Hollywood Independent Music Awards. Lorraine, age 23, said the experience was amazing. Even though I didn't win, just going there and being in that setting was great, she told the Wicked local. It was held in Avalon. There was a red carpet and interviews were going on. I had to sit back and realize my music had gotten me there. It was a really rewarding feeling. It felt good that something I had created was being recognized. Since 2023, the Hollywood Independent Music Awards has recognized the contributions and content creation of emerging and established artists, songwriters, composers, audio recording professionals throughout the world. Everyone there had the same understanding of all the time and effort that goes into our work, and we got to celebrate that with each other, said Lorraine. It was great having that platform to be able to shine light on independent artists, she said. Lorraine has been singing and creating songs since she was a kid, and anything could get her going. I remember walking down the aisles of the grocery store making up songs about what was on the shelves, she said. In middle school or early high school was when I started taking it seriously, writing down my songs in a journal and building the confidence to start sharing them with people. She credits her family for nurturing her musical side. My dad used to play the guitar in the living room, and me and my sister, who was also a good singer, used to just sit and sing and on and on. I don't know if I'd be the same position I'm now without having had that. More recently, Lorraine has been making a name for herself, drawing people to her website and playing in small venues throughout eastern Massachusetts. She said, I think performing live is very important. It helps you connect with an audience, and it builds confidence that you with the music you write. I like being able to share my music with people and pushing myself out of my comfort zone as an artist. Her songs are based on real-life events, those and others, from whatever prospect she feels the song needs. I also write about thoughts I'm having, she said. If I hear a phrase that catches my ear and sparks that creativity, I'll write it down. One of my most recent songs, called Pieces of Me, starts with the line, So typical, I heard a girl say that I loved it so much it made it into a song. Lorraine said the guitar is probably her main way of writing music. It's the one instrument I play live, unless I'm with a band, and then I'll play the tambourine. I'd like to do more shows with a band. She's releasing a new song later this month called Decisions. It's basically a song about how a lot of my decisions wind up being the root of the problems I have. She'll also take her songs on the road. I'd love to branch out, she said, maybe open for someone on tour, and show the world my writing and my music on a wider scale. Lorraine is looking forward to performing at the annual Mad Love Music Festival, which will be held on Sunday, October 11th, at the Jane Carr Amphitheater at the South Shore Conservatory, and that's at 1 Conservatory Drive in Hingham. It's a great cause, and there's been a great lineup every year, she said. It's excellent company to be in. Our next story is relevant to the Lindsay Clancy trial. It's entitled, How a TikTok Creator Ended Up as a Possible Witness. Lindsay Clancy's defense attorney is seeking to have a new witness found on TikTok testify about conditions at McLean Hospital during her murder trial. Clancy, now 36, is accused of killing 5-year-old Cora, 3-year-old Dawson, and 8-month-old Callan in January of that year. Prosecutors allege Clancy strangled them with exercise bands in the basement of their home while her husband, Patrick Clancy, was out running errands. Clancy's defense attorney, Kevin Reddington, has argued that she was over-medicated and lacked criminal responsibility due to mental illness, including postpartum depression and psychosis. She was left paralyzed from a jump from a second-story window the night the children were killed. On Tuesday, August 11th, Reddington argued that Emily Thorndike, a licensed independent clinical social worker and video creator with more than 52,300 followers on TikTok, should be allowed to take the witness stand for the defense. Thorndike previously worked at McLean Hospital in the short-term unit where Clancy stayed from January 1st to the 5th of 2023, a few weeks before the children's deaths, said Reddington. Though Thorndike was not working at McLean while Clancy was there, Reddington argued her experience working in the unit qualifies her to testify about its conditions. She now has her own practice called Wise Mind Therapy. Thorndike published a TikTok video on July 29th in which she said she needed to correct the misinformation that this prosecutor is saying about McLean and what the stay is like there. In the video, she refuted the prosecution's claims that Clancy was frequently assessed by psychiatrists and other mental health professionals while at McLean, particularly during the weekends and holidays, such as New Year's Day. Thorndike also said she believes Clancy was discharged from the psychiatric hospital much too early. McLean needs to be held accountable, said Thorndike. They clearly did not do their proper assessment when they granted her the discharge. I'm going to be straight up, and I'm going to say that as someone who's worked on that unit and had to approve discharge. Thorndike graduated from Dover Sherbourne High School. She earned a bachelor's degree in sociology from Hartwick College and a master's degree from Boston College in 2019, according to Reddington. She's licensed to practice in Massachusetts, according to the state healthcare professional license verification site. In court Tuesday, Reddington said he was able to track Thorndike down, speak with her on the phone, and confirm her previous employment. He said he vetted her out to make sure she didn't have any axe to grind in testifying in the trial. She is available, ready, willing, and able to testify to an employee's observations over 7 years, including as a supervisor, as to what woeful environment McLean Hospital offers, especially on holidays such as major holidays like New Year's, Reddington said. He also said that the prosecutors made McLean out to be some kind of five-star institution and that Clancy was just blithely refusing care and treatment. However, Reddington said that instead of receiving thorough treatment, Clancy simply colored and took walks while there. Patrick Clancy testified as to his observations. The court is aware that Patrick's testimony clearly, on all fours, landed on the fact that it was clear to him that there was no staff that was available other than kids behind plexiglass on their cell phones. She colored, she took walks, there was no therapy. She didn't speak to any therapists or counselors. Prosecutor Shannon Beckingham said she objected to allowing Thorndike to testify, saying the Commonwealth didn't have advance notice. She also said that because Thorndike is not being proposed as an expert witness, she would not be exempt from the court's sequestration order. And Buckingham said that appears Thorndike has been following the case. This woman's TikTok, admittedly, she's been following the trial. She goes on for several minutes in a very long TikTok video where she identifies what she thinks are lies based on her observations of Patrick Clancy's testimony, Buckingham said. We have no idea what her thoughts are or what her comments are on the rest of the trial that we assume she's watched based on her comments in this particular video. Buckingham said Thorndike's claims about Clancy's treatment at McLean are opinions and not facts, particularly because she was not working at McLean when Clancy was a patient. This person who said that she cares about Lindsay Clancy in this video, whether other people do or don't, this person who said that the prosecution of this case is an abomination, this person who said that the health profession needs to be held responsible for their care of the defendant, that's not a witness, that's present facts to this jury, Buckingham said. Judge William Sullivan said he would review his notes and decide whether to schedule a voir dire. McLean Hospital, founded in 1811, is the largest psychiatric teaching hospital of Harvard Medical School, according to the institution's website. The hospital's main campus is located at 115 Mill Street in Belmont. McLean treats children and teenagers, adults and older adults, with conditions such as addiction, anxiety, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, depression, eating disorders, OCD, schizophrenia, and trauma, and dissociative disorders. The psychiatric hospital specializes in hard-to-treat cases and in working with individuals who've been in treatment but are not achieving the desired treatment goals, the website says. McLean has locked inpatient units as well as outpatient services. The state of Massachusetts has kicked in $25 million in extra funding for literacy programs. The state announced nearly $25 million in funding to help increase early literacy among elementary students, with many districts in Worcester County getting a piece of the funding to help with initiatives aimed at the earliest readers getting up to grade level. Governor Maura Healey announced last week that $24.7 million would be handed out to 71 different school districts across the state to strengthen strengthen literacy instruction, with a particular focus on students between first and third grades. Reading is the foundation for everything students do in school and throughout their lives, said Healy. That's why we're making historic investments to strengthen literacy instruction, support educators, and help every student build the skills they need to succeed. The money will be distributed through the state's Partnership for Reading Success Massachusetts, which comprises four different programs that each focus on a different aspect of literacy. $10.2 million will be distributed to 13 different districts as PRISM 1 continuation grants, which allow the districts to continue helping improve their early literacy program so that all students can read at or above grade level by grade 3. This includes $579,750 for Northborough, Southborough Public Schools and $289,875 for Neshoba Regional School District. $2.59 million will be distributed to 13 different districts as PRISM 2 continuation grants that strengthens early literacy through the implementation of high-quality instructional materials in pre-K through third grade. None of the recipients are located in Worcester County, with the largest recipient being Pittsfield Public Schools. They are getting $466,500. $5.9 million will be distributed to 36 new districts as PRISM 2 second cohort grants, which aims to support the evaluation, selection, purchase, launch, and implementation of high-quality instructional materials for pre-K through third grade. This includes $313,000 for Southbridge Public Schools, $289,000 for Leominster Public Schools, $221,000 for Mendon-Upton Regional School District, $214,000 for Westboro Public Schools, $146,000 for Berlin-Boylston Public Schools, $117,000 for Quabbin Regional School District, $70,000 for Winchendon Public Schools, and $25,000 for Lunenburg Public Schools. $5.6 million will be distributed to 19 new districts as PRISM 3 second cohort grants, which supports resources, targeted coaching, and professional learning support to evaluate, select, purchase, launch, and implement high-quality instructional materials for grades 4 through 12. This includes $261,263 in funding for Southbridge Public Schools, $236,000 for Worcester Public Schools, and $221,000 for Quabbin Regional School District. In recent years, reading scores across the state have been in decline following the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2019, state reading scores were a full grade level above the national average. But as the most recent school year, Massachusetts reading scores are only a half grade above the national average. A study and review conducted by Education Scoreboard cites that students from wealthier communities have bigger improvements recovering from COVID-19 than students from lower income districts, meaning an extra funding from the state can help bridge the high gap needs. We're committed to strengthening implementation of high-quality literacy instruction and continuing to address persistent disparities in access and achievement, Elementary and Secondary Education Commissioner Pedro Martinez stated. Our work through PRISM grants and literacy launch institutes is designed to help all students become strong readers and writers. And next from Wrentham, the court finds probable cause to charge Mayer with assault and battery. A clerk magistrate found probable cause to charge Brockton Mayor Moises Rodriguez with assault and battery stemming from his alleged touching of a Brockton High student during a parade. Clerk magistrate Pamela Govan Fernandez heard from both sides during an August 7th show cause hearing. She made a decision public on August 14th after reviewing evidence and case law. A clerk at Wrentham District Court confirmed the finding of probable cause. In this case, it means the clerk magistrate found it more probable than not that the defendant committed the offense. The mayor has not yet been charged, however. That decision rests with state police and Plymouth County District Attorney's Office. Rodriguez Chief of Staff Sidney Morrow said he had no immediate statement on the development. The mayor has been advised to make no comment at this time, as this is a pending legal matter. State police had applied to charge the mayor with assault and battery following their investigation of the incident. The student said the mayor approached her at the May 22nd parade and grabbed her by the waist and touched her shoulders, making her uncomfortable. She later became distraught and hid in a Brockton High bathroom to avoid the mayor, who had come to the school to apologize after a school official told him he'd upset a student with his behavior at the parade. Brockton Police Chief Brenda Perez had asked the state police to take over the probe. Captain John Santos of the state police presented the Commonwealth's case on August 7th hearing. He read aloud a 17-page summary of the interviews he and other troopers conducted. Santos concluded that Rodriguez did intentionally touch the student during the parade and that the touching was not consensual. Santos said he believed there was probable cause to charge Rodriguez with one count of assault and battery. Lawyers for Rodriguez argued that photos and video from the event do not show him touching the girl. The overwhelming video and photographic evidence is compelling, not for what it shows, but for what it does not show, said one of the mayor's lawyers, former Judge Mark Lawton, on August 7th hearing. It doesn't show any touching. At least one photo visible to a reporter in the courtroom appeared to show the mayor with his hand on the student's back. The judge in the harassment prevention hearing found that Rodriguez did touch her. Judge Scott Peterson characterized the touching as unwelcome, offensive, and certainly unprofessional. Rodriguez's testimony in Rentham differed somewhat from what he said in Hingham during a hearing that resulted in a judge lifting a harassment prevention order, keeping the mayor 100 yards away from the girl. Both times he said he doesn't remember touching her. At the June 22nd court session, Rodriguez said, "I believe it's possible I put my hand on her shoulder. If she said I did, then I believe her." At the show cause hearing in Rentham, he did not give that caveat. "I don't recall for the life of me. You can't tell in their marching band uniform if they're a boy or a girl. I saw the young lady in the court in Hingham. I do not recall ever coming into contact with the girl." Rodriguez told the clerk magistrate that he remembers fixing one band member's hat and taking a flag and a baton from two other students. "I don't recall touching anybody or putting my arms around in an inappropriate way." Attorneys for Rodriguez argued that much of the evidence in the case did not come from first-hand accounts. The legal term for that is hearsay. "Not just hearsay, but quadruple hearsay," said Philip Nassarella, a former longtime Brockton City solicitor, now in private practice. "You see an individual walking among thousands of people, not just an individual, but a politician." Santos, in his summary of the interview with Brockton Police School's music director, Rebecca Desmond, said she saw the alleged incident. "Based on the way Rodriguez was positioned, Desmond felt it looked like they knew each other," Santos said, though she stated it was difficult to see any expression on the girl's face. Lawyers for the mayor also argued that the student was hypersensitive to contact after a boy her age invaded her space. Outside the court, in his first interview with the Enterprise, the father of the student, Junior Pena, said that 3 or 4 weeks before the parade, she was walking out of the bathroom when a boy approached her and tried to kiss her. The girl pushed the boy away. Lawton said context matters and that not every touching is criminal. Nassarella picked up a similar argument. "If it were so, everyone would have to be bubble-wrapped. It defies what the legislature intended when we came to this term of assault and battery." Lawton also entered into evidence an affidavit from the mother of the girl that, he claimed, shows the family plans to file a civil case against the mayor. "We suggest it's a financial motive that we would like the court to consider," said Lawton. Pena, the father of the girl, said his family is not looking for a payday. "We don't need the money. The only thing we need to know and want to make sure is that our voice is heard, is that the children of the state of Massachusetts know that they have a voice, know that they can speak, and that they should not be quiet." After the June harassment prevention order hearing, a lawyer for the girl's family said he believed there's a basis for civil liability because Rodriguez has not learned to keep his hands to himself. The mayor testified on August 7th that no previous complaints have been made against him. "I have mentored hundreds of young kids," he said. "Not once in my lifetime has someone come forward and said I did something inappropriate." Building on reporting by the Enterprise, Boston radio station GBH said a second high school student contacted school officials after their mayor touched her at a school event. A now-deleted Instagram post caught the moment during a group photo which, according to the radio station, left the girl, quote-unquote, distressed. In court on August 7th, Rodriguez noted that his wife, Maria, has for nearly 30 years run a daycare out of their Brockton home. "I have never been to court. To me, this is very foreign," the mayor said. The mayor's attorney also raised a political defense. Nasarella said there's a dot board on every opponent's wall targeting the first-term mayor. Officials moved the hearing out of Brockton, as it often does with cases involving public figures, to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest. It was held at the Wrentham District Court. Next from USA Today, mass hearings held in immigration courts. Lines have stretched out the front door of courthouses. Overflow seating has been set up in the hallways. There's been a classroom-style exchanges with judges asking people to raise their hands in response to generic questions about their cases. These are some of the scenes that have been playing out in immigration courts across the country as the Trump administration increasingly has turned to mass hearings in an effort to push more cases through the cumbersome immigration system. These so-called mega master hearings, which pack dozens of cases of more into a single proceeding, are meant to cut down on the large backlog of cases in immigration courts run by the Justice Department, federal officials say. Critics argue the effort slashes the already limited due process that immigrants receive, giving them less meaningful time before a judge. One of the central concerns is that immigrants are having their scheduled court dates moved up months or even years, leaving them little time to prepare. Critics also say confusion over the fast-paced proceedings has led more people to miss their court dates. "This will push many more people into deportation proceedings," said Muzaffar Christie, a senior fellow at the Nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. The preliminary mass hearings offer individuals an opportunity to enter pleas or relief as such asylum, although the administration has made it easier for immigration authorities to deny asylum claims. The uptick in these hearings since May have come as detentions and deportations have surged in recent weeks, this according to data from the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. While mass hearings with 20 or 30 people have been commonplace for years, the size of these recent hearings is concerning immigration attorneys, who describe them as intentionally rushed and chaotic. Supporters say the effort could cut down the more than 3.4 million cases pending in immigration courts, which have already been severely backlogged. "This is a very effective way to reduce the backlog," said Matt O'Brien. He's a former immigration judge and a deputy executive director of Federation for American Immigration Reform, a group that advocates for stricter limits on migration. "Reducing the immigration court backlog remains one of the highest priorities for this administration," according to the Justice Department. In recent months, the immigration attorneys have reported a sharp increase in the number of large-scale hearings in immigration courts across the country, from Iowa to Texas to New Jersey and Massachusetts. Over 1,300 such hearings were held in June alone, a nearly threefold jump from the same period in 2025, according to data analyzed by Mobile Pathways, a nonprofit that tracks immigration court data. Joseph Perez, an immigration attorney based in Virginia, said he's had clients in hearings with 20 to 30 other people. "These smaller hearings are more typical," and he described them as manageable, not only for immigrants, but for the judges and the court staff as well. "These larger hearings go on all day. It's unreasonable," he said. In Chicago, immigration lawyers described hearings with nearly 200 people before a single immigration judge. Respondents crowded in the hallways and inside the courtrooms. Once the proceedings began, the ones in the back struggled to hear the judge's questions. "The sheer scale of these mega master hearings is truly unprecedented," said Kiki Mosley, who's the chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. In a statement, the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which oversees immigration courts under the DOJ, said it prioritizes the timely completion of all cases and makes scheduling adjustments as needed to ensure cases do not languish. The mass hearings have coincided with a sharp increase in the number of cases ruled in absentia, meaning a judge issued a deportation order after someone failed to appear in court. Of the 10,370 people assigned to hearings in June, 58% were ruled absent, this according to Justice Department data analyzed by Mobile Pathways. Mosley and other immigration lawyers said officials provided little notice to people whose court dates were moved up by several months or, in some cases, even years. Advocates said some didn't show up because they're scared of being arrested inside the courthouse, a tactic the Trump administration employed for months before it was blocked from doing so in 2025. Other immigrants reportedly showed up but were issued removal orders because of chaos. We've witnessed immigrants being ordered removed for missing their court dates, not because they didn't come to court, but because they arrived on time and amid the overcrowding and confusion could not find the correct courtroom or hear their case being called. Immigration attorneys said the Trump administration is relying on the high rates of absentia orders to close cases, issue removal orders, and funnel more immigrants into deportation proceedings. On June 9th, University of Iowa law student Chase McLaren attended what's believed to be the first mega master hearing in Omaha, Nebraska. McLaren said the judge issued orders in a rapid-fire manner. Every person who did not attend the day's hearing received removal orders. If you miss court, your case could be over, McLaren said. Andrew Arthur, a resident fellow in law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies, said the federal government has the burden of proving it served a hearing notice at an immigrant's last known address. If the government fails to do that and someone is ordered removed, the respondent can move to reopen the case. Immigration courts were experiencing a backlog of over 3.4 million cases as of June, according to the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which oversees immigration courts. That number was down from 3.7 million a year earlier and a high of 3.9 million in the final year of the Biden administration, this according to government data. We'll end today's reading with a little bit of history trivia. On this date in 1590, John White, governor of Roanoke Island Colony, present-day North Carolina, returned to Roanoke after nearly 3 years abroad, only to find the settlement deserted. The fate of the lost colony still remains a mystery. And in this date, in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, guaranteeing American women's right to vote, was ratified as Tennessee became the 36th state to approve it. In 1914, President Woodrow Wilson issued his Proclamation of Neutrality, aimed at keeping the United States out of World War I. In 1958, Vladimir Nabokov's novel Lolita was published in the United States. In 1963, James Meredith became the first black student to graduate from the University of Mississippi. In 1969, the Woodstock Music and Art Fair in Bethel, New York, wound to a close after 3 days and nights with a mid-morning set by Jimi Hendrix. And in 1983, Hurricane Alicia slammed into the Texas coast, leaving 21 dead and causing more than $1 billion worth of damage. And in 2005, a judge in Wichita, Kansas, sentenced BTK serial killer Dennis Rader to 10 consecutive life terms, the maximum the law would allow. And in 2014, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon ordered the National Guard to Ferguson, a suburb of St. Louis, convulsed by protests over the fatal shooting of a black 18-year-old whose name was Michael Brown. And that's a wrap for the Patriot Ledger for Tuesday, August 18th. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you all have a great day.